Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for December 23rd, 2016. You're hearing a little preview of what's coming up this weekend on Christmas night. At 7 p.m. on Sunday, WCRB in Concert will feature this music in a program called Christmas in 15th Century France and Burgundy, performed by Blue Heron just last weekend at First Church in Cambridge. When we began WCRB in Concert last fall, this is exactly the kind of thing we hoped to be able to do, bring you great performances from concerts around Boston that remind us why music matters in our world. For me, what Blue Heron does in every concert, and especially in their Christmas concerts, is throw everything going on around us, politics, current events, culture, into a different perspective. From the long perspective of centuries, we hear through music that a lot of what we're feeling and experienced through today's world is pretty much the same as what people have felt and experienced for a long time. Beyond that, Blue Heron, through their work as an ensemble, embodies a way of relating to one another that you'll hear more about on this podcast. Scott Metcalf will talk about that in a preview of this Sunday's broadcast. Also on the air this Christmas weekend, Ron Della Chiesa is your host for a Christmas-themed Boston Symphony broadcast that includes Tchaikovsky's complete score for The Nutcracker, recorded by Seiji Ozawa and the BSO in 1990. That's at 8 p.m. tomorrow. And next weekend for New Year's Day on WCRB in Concert, we'll take you back to one of the highlights of 2016, when Renee Fleming, Susan Graham, Franz Hawlata, and Aaron Morley came to Symphony Hall for Richard Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier with the Boston Symphony and music director Andres Nelsons. That'll be on the air at 7 p.m. on Sunday, January 1st. Blue Heron was founded in 1999, and for its entire existence, Scott Metcalf has been its artistic leader. Scott is a performer and scholar who prepares most of what Blue Heron does based on original sources and research. And when I talked with him in between the two performances of Christmas in 15th Century France in Burgundy last Saturday, I began by asking him what makes the music on that program different from other parts of the world at the time.
Wow, that's a good question. The French Burgundian, Franco-Burgundian style in the 15th century is really the mainstream core of European music, because those French and Burgundian musicians, and they're all French, actually. Burgundy, they're just cousins. You know, it's the same place. It's the same. They overlap. They're all married to each other. These French and Flemish musicians are these northern-trained singers who all grew up in choir schools in the northern cathedrals. They're the people who are most in demand all over Europe as singers and as composers. So they're in the Papal Chapel, and they're in Italian courts, and they're in the south of France, and they're all over the place. And it's their style of composing and presumably singing, which everyone wants to emulate. So how would we tell the difference between this and English music, for example? English music in this period is maybe sweeter, more consonant in a way. More overall consonant. It's got a kind of sweetness that's caused by a saturation of major thirds, really, and triads. Whereas the continental music, a little bit more angular, a little bit more intellectual feeling, but these are gross generalizations. You know, you find these kind of stylistic traits on either side of the channel. And there are English musicians working in France, and there are French musicians. Well, their music at least goes to England, perhaps some French musicians as well. In Italy is the big difference, and we have hardly any Italian polyphony from this period. The stuff that's being written by Italians is really not being written down so much as it's being improvised, and it's a sort of popular music. We don't have, or their instrumental musicians in Italy, but we don't have this kind of complicated Italian polyphony until the 16th century when, you know, who comes along? Marenzio, and it's Villart, who's a Flemish musician who goes, he becomes the maestro di cappella at San Marco in Venice, and he is the absolute epitome of Venetian music. And then his successors are the Gabrielli's and eventually Monteverdi.
Yeah, wow. Well, okay, well, that's really fascinating. I did not realize that this music that you're singing in this program is really the heart and soul of European music of that particular time. So that's pretty cool.
That's partly an artifact of the way we study music now. You know, it's part of the arc of our narrative of the Western canon, that the French repertory of the 15th century is the center. That's the kind of, what do we call the central tradition.
So the thing about music that's this old is that some of it exists in edited forms and published, and then other parts of it I know from talking to you in the past is really only in facsimiles of manuscripts or whatever. How much of this program is already sort of published that you could maybe just pick up and work with? And how much did you have to do? I know you love to do your preparation anyway. So how much did you do your own personal preparation of the music?
We are using my editions for almost everything that we're doing on the concert. On the other hand, most of it is also available in some sort of published form. Some of this stuff got published in the early years of 20th century musicology. The great waves of publishing started in the sort of middle of the 20th century, and just norms have changed. The kind of things that we want to see on the page have really changed. We have different ideas about performance practice in some cases. So we're mostly using my editions or editions from, you know, my friends who have worked on this stuff recently and shared their editions.
Yeah. And for the ensemble, I mean, this group of singers does this a lot, and they do it a lot together. So maybe there's not too much of a sort of ramp up into locking into place with each other. But what are the particular challenges of this music on this program for the singers that they've really got to hone in rehearsals?
It's very ornate rhythmically. The relationships between the parts are very, very tricky rhythmically. You'll hear that especially in the Regis Motet, O Admirabile Commercium, which is a real tour de force of rhythmic writing and rhythmic manipulation. I think that when you hear it, the opening of the piece, it's almost incomprehensible, the rhythm. He's setting the listener up to not be able to tell what meter it's in. And you really can't tell for a while. Eventually you realize that the meter he's in is what is like our 9/8. And by the time he wrote that motet, that's a very archaic time signature, we might say, to write in. So it must have been, it's sort of novelty for the singers as well. And then he keeps complicating things over and over through the piece, so it's very complex. That's maybe the most complicated of all pieces, but these composers do like their complicated counterpoint.
Yeah, yeah, and it sort of ties to another thing I was wondering as I listened to the music. What I always found amazing about any great vocal group is the unity of beginning a note, but even more surprisingly beautiful is the unity of ending a note. That always seems to be the thing that separates great vocal ensembles from pretty good vocal ensembles. And that totally depends on a sense of rhythm. You have to know where you are in time to do that together. So with those complex rhythms that you're describing and with just simply ending notes together, how does do you practice with a metronome, or do you conduct more in rehearsals than we see you conducting in concerts? Or how does a group really develop that sense of time together?
I think the only way to do it is to rehearse a lot and perform a lot together, and maybe have somebody in charge who's got a sort of deciding vote about how you're going to settle things. But, you know, I mean, one way you can do that is to have somebody conduct. But in fact, that only solves the rhythmic problem on the surface. It might solve it at a deeper level, but really everybody in the group has to develop the same sense of rhythm. I think that is one of the hardest things for an ensemble to do, because we all bring slightly different senses of pulse and of the how time elapses and what's the relationship between the divisions of beats and so forth. But working on the swing of the big beat, we do a lot of work on it. And it's a never-ending process.
And when you are, I mean, there's so many pieces in this program and in a lot of Blue Heron programs where it's just three singers or four singers. And as the music director, in rehearsals, how much do you sort of say, here's how we're going to do it? And how much do you sort of let the ensemble that's working on it just organically come to their own sense of it?
It's really both. Yeah. You know, I come with a lot of ideas about how it might go and some sense of the poetry and the language and a sort of maybe a big view, or I just know the pieces a little better than they do because I edited them. You know? But, you know, there's no sense in which this is a dictatorship. You know, it's sort of an enlightened despotism, really, though. You know, but it's more than that. I mean, because polyphony is really, it is actual democracy in practice. Everybody has to be a full participant at all times. And, you know, you can not get your way at a certain moment, but you go with the consensus of the whole group. But that consensus gets developed out of a lot of process. And I think we try stuff out. Everyone is free to put ideas on the table. It's chamber music. That's the only way that chamber music works. And it's in 15th century music and 16th century music where the parts are entirely equal. You know, there's no kind of hierarchy. There's no sort of first violinist and viola part, which is a sort of oompa-pa. The viola part is exactly the same importance as the top part, and so the melodies shift from place to place. So you can never hear everything that's going on. So that's, I mean, that is the perfect democratic music. It's real democracy in action.
I love that. I love the drawing of a parallel between what you're doing on stage and the way that we interact as human beings just in general. That's a really kind of inspiring thought. I like that a lot.
I think that's what chamber music, any kind of music, that actually is one of the deep practices of why we're doing this. I mean, yes, it's diverting, it's entertaining, it can be incredibly spiritual, it can be incredibly moving, but another thing we're doing is practicing living together and working together as human beings in front of a lot of other human beings when we get up on stage, finally.
You always put together such beautiful notes that people, I mean, anytime I tell someone to go to a Blue Heron concert, I say, get there half an hour early, seriously, to digest all the stuff that you can read that Scott put together. And in the notes for this concert, you talk about these New Year's pieces, and it's a fantastic scene setting that you're doing there. And you mention that there's really only about 27 or so of these songs that still are around. How did you choose the six or so that you put into the program?
We have done this program a few times before. We come back to it in some form every other year. And we've bounced around from song. We've sort of tried out one of the others. Some of them are just better than others. There are, if I'm not mistaken, there's some that are missing parts of their text. So they may be great. But at this point, we need actually a poet who can compose 15th century French. And I'm looking, so if anyone hears this, you can find me on the web and let me know, because there actually are some other pieces that need wonderful pieces that just we can't really do because they're missing part of their text. And one of the problems with the sources is a lot of these songs got written down in Italy by Italian scribes who often don't seem to know French very well or really at all. Yeah. So they garble things, or they just leave it out. And sometimes the music only survives in a source which is written down for an instrumental ensemble. So all they tell you is the title, or they tell you the incipit of the first words and nothing else. So if that's the only source, well, then you can do it with instruments, but you can't do the vocal original. The Baudricordier song that we're doing on this, Dame Excellente, is a case in point. It's a ballade. Normally, ballades have three stanzas. In the musical sources, you find them with one, two, or three. This one only has one, and there's a single source. It feels really short for the content of the music, and we really wish we could do at least one more stanza. So,
wow.
Someday we'll make one up.
And as you say, a good opportunity for someone out there. One of the other things about a Blue Heron concert is your attention, the entire ensemble's attention to the experience of the audience. I mean, the stagecraft, we'll call it. It's not elaborate. There's not huge things going on with lighting and blocking and all that stuff. But you pay such close attention to where singers are, where the movement happens, and especially where the lighting happens. And that's really important in this concert. Tell me about how you, especially with the lighting, how did you sort of come up with the scheme that you did for the concert?
Well, partly it's a holiday concert. So we're at First Church, and there's a Christmas tree, and there's poinsettias all over the place. So that there's already this sort of element of decoration. And we love to have the candlelight. I mean, candlelight makes it really, really beautiful. In there, it catches the gold of the dome in the chancel. Part of the lighting has to do with the narrative arc of the concert, that it starts at the darkest time of the year and starts in Advent, where it's penitential and preparatory. And the first couple pieces are very mysterious on this program. The Obrecht, which is this huge assemblage of many, many, many texts, Advent texts, but also has these very striking Lenten texts. There's a couple of texts from Lent in there that are very, very emotionally powerful. This moment of homophony that happens in the first section. So everything comes to a stop. It's been rolling along with this very complicated music. But suddenly we get to a cadence, it stops. And then everyone says in rhythmic unison these passages. This is where the Lenten texts come in. And they say, in the midst of life, we are in death. This is it's warming up for what's coming. It's because we're here in the midst of death that the Savior is meant to come, and that we call out, you know, we'd say, blow the trumpet in Zion, because here he comes. And it's an amazing piece. I find that quite heart-stopping. So it's not a light-saturated Christmas piece, right? So it's wonderful, I think, to have that underlined by just a little bit of lighting.
Yeah. And then
as things roll, you know, as we get through Advent, it becomes more and more hopeful, and we come to an Ave Maria, signaling the moment of conception. Now, of course, that happens in March, not December, but it's recalled in every telling of the Christmas story.
Yeah. No, I mean, that is part of Advent, is to recall the conception.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the lights come up, and then it's Christmas, and we sing this Regis motet on this program, O Admirabile.
Yeah. And then it felt like, as I listened to it, that it was a big effect for the audience, that the way that lighting worked. But I kind of just had maybe in my ears that the singers themselves were singing more brightly. I mean, of course, you know the meaning of the words, and you're meaning to communicate those words, but it just feels like there's as much effect on the singers as there is on the audience when the lighting changes.
Absolutely, yes. I think it really changes the emotional feel of it for us as well.
Yeah. Coming up for the rest of the season with Blue Heron, what highlights are there? You're releasing a recording. Or you just released it?
No, we're releasing the fifth recording of our 5-CD set of music from the Peterhouse Part Books, this English music from the 16th century. So that's coming out in March with only composers you never heard. Anonymous, Mason Hunt, Sturmey, where it's the only piece that survives by one of these guys.
All right.
That's in March. And we're concluding our season with a program of that English music, sort of highlights from the 5 CDs. And Nick Sandon, the English musicologist composer who's recomposed the missing parts, is coming to speak, and we'll have a whole day of activities around the part books and with Nick Sandon. That's on April 29th, I believe. It's the last Saturday. The concert's on the last Friday, and the day of activity is the last Saturday. We have another Ockeghem concert coming up, and we're doing the complete works of Ockeghem over several seasons. So the fifth concert is in February, doing the Caput Mass. We're going to do a concert at the National Gallery of Art in Washington in February of Dufay and Banchois, music that was for Florence, music that was in Florence, written in Florence, written about Florence in the 1430s and 40s. And that's in conjunction with an exhibition of Della Robbia, which just is closing or just closed at the MFA, and it's now going to the National Gallery of Art.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, Scott, thanks for taking some time to talk with me today.
Thanks, Brian. It's a pleasure.
Scott Metcalf is the music director of Blue Heron, and you'll hear the program we talked about, Christmas in 15th Century France and Burgundy, this Sunday at 7 p.m. on WCRB in Concert. You'll also have the chance to hear that concert on demand after the broadcast at our website, classicalwcrb.org. That's where you can also see what's coming up on WCRB in Concert, including the BSO's performance of Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier on January 1st, and later in the month, the Martin Luther King Day concert from the Boston Children's Chorus. You can subscribe to The Answered Question at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app, and you'll also find TAQ at WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. The podcast will return with a new episode on January 6th. Thanks to Scott Metcalf and John Yannis of Blue Heron for their time and effort in bringing you this podcast and Sunday night's broadcast. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.